Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. So happy to have you with us. Questions? What do you have as an issue maybe for caring for your pet? I hope you'll call us at 1-800-642-1234. And Sandy, great to have you back.
It's nice to be here.
You know, one of the issues I think that people have is when to know if your cat or your dog is in pain. They're really good at hiding pain.
They are. And, you know, it really got me thinking about this because I had a doctor's appointment not too long ago, and they said, you know, rate your pain level on a scale of 1 to 10. And, boy, I wish we could do that with our patients, but we can't because they can't tell us. And so, you know, and even if they are in pain, many of them don't show any signs of it. It's kind of this natural preservation response. Out in the wild and all of a sudden you're limping or showing signs that you're not comfortable, you're going to be someone's lunch because you're going to get picked out of the herd pretty quickly. So, and dogs and cats, you know, even though they're not in that type of environment, do the same thing. They want to hide their pain. So what are some of the things that we look at? Well, like for cats, we know that for cats 12 years and up, 90% of them probably have some type of arthritis. And yet very few cats limp or show any changes that way like we would or a dog would. And so sometimes it's just subtle things like not being able to jump up on the counters as easily or being a little more hesitant, maybe having a little trouble manipulating the litter box, managing the litter box, being able to
getting
get
in and
out.
Yeah.
Right. And so those would be signs to be able to be watching for. Sometimes the cats that are uncomfortable will groom excessively over a joint that may be bothering them, or just the opposite, lack of grooming, where their back hurts or they're arthritic and they can't turn to be able to clean themselves, and so they start getting hair mats and their hair coat looks greasy. And that tells me that they're pretty uncomfortable if they're going to be letting themselves get to be in that kind of condition. Purring is one of those things for cats that is really confusing because we'll see cats that are in obvious discomfort delivering kittens or maybe just waking up from an orthopedic procedure, and yet they're purring. And we know that the purring isn't a sign that they're happy. It may be a method that cats use to make themselves feel more comfortable and relaxed by convincing themselves, hey, if I purr, maybe I'll be mm-hmm. a little more comfortable. So you can't really base it on, oh, my cat's not purring anymore, or my cat is still purring, they can't be painful. Dogs, you know, they're really different. When they're young, they'll vocalize often, kind of like a baby crying. But as they get older, that vocalization, they tend to not do it. And like cats, they tend to hide it more. But, you know, what we'll have to watch is, you know, are they having trouble getting up and down? Are they slower on the stairs? You know, watching body language. Are when they are trying to get up, are their ears going back and their pupils dilating? They may be a little more rigid. Those would be things that we'd be wanting to watch for too. So it's, you know, it's a matter of knowing your pet and anticipating that, hey, you know, if they're this age and we've just done something to them surgically that, you know, they are probably going to be painful, and getting them on board with medication for pain early, because as time goes by, they can become hypersensitive, and we see this pain system kind of ramping up. So, you know, talk to your veterinarian. If you think your pet's uncomfortable, there's lots of things we can do, everything from medications and supplements to physical therapy, massage, acupuncture, chiropractic, which I actually have to call spinal manipulative therapy, all kinds of things that we can do to really make our pets have a much happier, healthy life.
Well, that's really great information to share. And there are the American Animal Hospital Association has a whole list of these things to watch out for, as you just covered.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And that's a wonderful website. They have areas on there for pet owners to be able to go, and everything from, you know, just kind of everyday things like this, how to recognize pain, to, you know, what's being recalled lately, and, you know, new outbreaks on diseases and things like that. So I think it's a really helpful spot to go. I go there before every show just to make sure that I'm up to date.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. Question for her about your pet's health. call in 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question on our Facebook page, or maybe a photo there, a pet photo as well, and our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. That's the place to go. Tracy in Wauwatosa, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I have this wonderful 8-month-old. She's a black lab mix, and she has what's called dew claws in back, or actually double ones. And I've sort of been having a hard time on deciding if I should have them removed or not. I had one estimate done, and cost kind of is a factor. It was, she said, between $1,000 to $1,500. And I've heard some people saying, no, you don't need to. Some saying yes. And now I don't hunt, but I do go hiking and jogging, and I take her to dog parks. And so she's outside a lot, and she's playing with other dogs. And I see these things hanging and dangling on the back.
Uh-huh.
But then again, I also heard when they're removed, it's not the most wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think it's just more my personal choice, or what have you experienced?
That's a really good question. You know, dew claws are one of those things that if you kind of look at your hand, your thumb would be considered the anatomic equivalent to a dew claw. And we have, obviously, bones that attach our thumb up to the rest of our hand. And for some dogs, they have that whole bony attachment. So those dew claws are nice and tight and up against the leg and are probably not going to cause the pet any troubles. Other dogs, though, will have some of those bones missing. So they have the nail-producing tissue there. And so that last little bit of bone is there. But imagine your thumb missing the two bones that passed where the nail is attached. You're just going to have this floppy thing kind of hanging in the air. And for the majority of dogs, a dangling dew claw like that is not going to cause any problems if you keep that nail trimmed. The little dangly dew claws like that tend to get... the nail will kind of grow around and can cause the dog discomfort if it comes in contact with the tissue. And we've actually seen them growing into itself, like back into the pad. So keeping them trimmed would be really helpful just to avoid having them getting caught on things. You know, there's some breeds of dogs where double dew claws in the back are required to show them. Breeds like Great Pyrenees, if they don't have double dew claws, then you can't put them in the show ring. So, you know, and breeders that that have dogs that we know are going to be hunting dogs will often, when the puppies are 2 or 3 days of age, remove any dew claws that are there. It's a very minor procedure. The puppy may make a little yip, and they get over it very quickly, and it's, you know, but they don't have to worry about them later on. But as an adult dog, you're right, this is major surgery. You're dealing with sometimes having to amputate some bones, cutting through nerves and blood vessels. Your pet would probably need to be on pain medication and restricted activity for a couple of weeks because of having this done. So it is something to be thinking about. So I think if you can be a good owner with making sure that your dog is having regular pedicures done more frequently with those dew claws, it may not be a problem. If one of them does get caught on something and torn, then you have the option of, you know, having them removed at that time. And I think that if it was my dog, I'd probably just let them go unless, you know, they did get damaged on something. And then I would say, well, then, you know, well, let's just get rid of them at that point. So
yeah, there
just
you go.
Watch.
All right.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks.
Yep. Thanks, Tracy, for calling. Appreciate it. Sarah and Racine, it's your turn. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
My question is in regards to my 16-year-old Siberian Husky German Shepherd mix, and I know people hear 16 and they think that's really, really old, and it is, but she's otherwise a pretty healthy dog, still really active and likes to play with our younger dogs, minus some weakness that she's starting to experience in her back legs and then some incontinence issues that have increased over the last year, and most recently within the past couple of months just isn't responding to her current medication. So I was curious if there are newer medications or alternative treatments available that might help us to get the incontinence issues under control, so the poor thing isn't having to be subjected to daily baths.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
What are you currently...
75-pound dog.
Yeah, what are you currently using for medication?
She's on Proen.
Proen, okay.
She's been up to about what our vet is saying about the max dose she can have. So she's at about... 1 milligram, about 3 times daily. She gets 1.5 tablets twice a day,
okay.
So about 3 milligrams total. And we tried to pair that with DES, and that seemed to work. She was on an every other day, every 48-hour regimen with that. And we noticed that on the days that she wasn't combining the DES with the prime, that she would have accidents. But there was some question as to whether or not it was safe to have her on the DES as part of a daily regimen.
Yeah.
Too high of a dosage and some other issues that might creep in.
Yeah, well, this when we see dogs that are incontinent, it can happen any time post spay. Sometimes with when they're still puppies. Sometimes it's not until they get older and they start having some other kind of concurrent medical issues that may either be things like disease that's making them make more urine, things like Cushing's disease or kidney problems, where they're making more urine and the bladder sphincter that would work fine before now just can't hold back the dam, and so they get more leakage. You also mentioned that your dog has some hind end weakness, and I worry about neurologic problems where it may not be just a bladder sphincter issue, but it may actually be a problem with the nerves going to the bladder causing her to be incontinent. And so if her incontinence is also accompanied with some decreased rectal tone, anal tone, and maybe some fecal leakage every once in a while, that's a whole different ball of wax to have to deal with, and probably putting her on these medications is not going to be helpful. But I do have a couple of suggestions for you. The issue with Proin in 16-year-old dogs is Proin is a drug called phenylpropanolamine, and one of the side effects of it is it does increase blood pressure in dogs, and young dogs rarely ever have hypertension, but older dogs that can have some of these other diseases like kidney disease and Cushing's disease can be hypertensive. And you add Proin on top of that, and that can make it worse. So I do hope that your veterinarian is very carefully monitoring your dog's blood pressure, because I would be if I had a 16-year-old dog on Proin. But there is another drug that you may find that you can use safer than DES. DES is a diethylstilbestrol. It's a steroid that is not commercially available. You have to go through formulating pharmacies to get it. And it is a potent enough steroid that typically most dogs that are on it, we only use maybe about once a week to be able to keep them under control. More frequent use can suppress the bone marrow and can result in something called aplastic anemia. And so we want to be, if you were using that on an every other day basis, I'd be watching her blood cell counts very carefully as well. But there's a new drug on the market that is an estrogen that is labeled only for dog use. It goes by the brand name of Incurin, Incurin, and it is designed to be able to be used on a daily basis. It's a very safe estrogen for dog use. And if you found that Proin by itself isn't controlling her, but Proin and an estrogen works better, Incurin would be the way to go, because you can add that in with the Proin and very safely have her on that on an everyday basis.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah. And then as far as the weakness, I was looking into some underwater treadmill work for her.
Mm-hmm.
There's a location relatively close to me, about a half hour away, that does that. Is that something that would at least kind of help her maintain some muscle tone, even if there is an underlying neurological issue, just to kind of make her
enjoy
it.
Right. My own dog just had bilateral elbow surgery done last month, and he was in last week for one of his physical therapy appointments. And it's amazing what physical therapy can do for maintaining muscle mass or even improving it in the case of dogs such as, you know, mine that was postoperative. And the underwater treadmill is really interesting. You want to make sure that they are treating the water appropriately, that it is chlorinated and kept clean and regularly, because especially with dogs that are incontinent, it can be a real mess for trying to clean this thing up, because they kind of just drain the water out, not totally. It goes down into a holding area and then it refills again. And if your dog is comfortable in the water, and, you know, it would be probably a really good thing to do, but I would do that in conjunction with some other strengthening exercises. And so not just looking at the underwater treadmill, but maybe some other things that you can do to help improve, body, like core strength and body balance. I actually have for my dog at home a balance board that we're training him to go up on, and it's quite fun. And he's actually enjoying it because he gets fed while I'm doing it. And so there's lots of things like that that you can do at home. And so working with someone who is trained in animal physical therapy is really going to give your dog a better quality of life and hopefully, longer life that they can stay with you.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Sarah. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Brianne Chasso, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Great to have you listening in. Call in 1-800-642-1234. If you got a great pet photo and question, you can also post it on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Mary in Wales emailed and wondered if you could talk about hemangiosarcoma. Sarcoma,
yeah.
Excuse me. She had it in her 11-year-old beagle. It was diagnosed in early December, and the beagle died by January 4th.
Oh, this is one of those very common types of cancer that we see that is often surprising for the owner because their pet can be healthy, 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 and then all of a sudden they find them collapsed or potentially have already died overnight. And it's probably one of the more leading causes of sudden death in dogs. And, excuse me, what this is it's a type of cancer of blood vessels. And so you can imagine that it can spread very rapidly. And any time that it is a cancer of blood vessels, those new vessels that are being formed in this cancerous mass are going to be very fragile, and they can rupture easily. I had a golden retriever in that I saw for the very first time. It was a family with a 14-year-old golden retriever that had just moved here to the area and came in to have just a wellness exam done. They didn't have any concerns. And on abdominal palpation, I found a large abdominal mass and told them that it, very well could be something like this. The dog came in later that evening bleeding, and it may have been from me just gently palpating the mass that did it. It could be that the dog slipped and fell, but the dog ended up dying later that evening. They ended up having him euthanized. I've had my own dog actually develop this kind of cancer as well. I had a basset hound that developed a type of hemangiosarcoma called cutaneous hemangiosarcoma. Rather than being in an organ like the spleen, it was actually in his skin. And even though the mass was quite small, and we had wide margins and had it removed, I still put him through chemotherapy, and he ended up enjoying life for about another 4 months before it had already started to show signs in his lungs and other places too. So, but even once you've diagnosed it, you have to assume that it's already spread. And so it's something to consider if you're going to be contemplating surgery or going through therapy or anything like that. But it's not a nice type of cancer. I'm very sorry that you lost your dog, but having them for a month after diagnosis is pretty good.
Gina on Facebook says she tried to walk her pug last night, but they didn't get very far before he started wheezing and couldn't go on. She brought him back inside, and he was fine once he was back inside. Is this common for pugs to have trouble breathing in the cold?
Very possible, because they've got that really short nose and they're trying to breathe. If they're getting, any, just like us, it will sometimes get our nostrils and things will get quite sensitive. That may have been what was triggering this. So, and this is what it comes down to. When you've got a pet that you're taking outside in very cold weather, you have to know your pet's limits, not only because of their age. Young dogs, old dogs aren't going to be able to tolerate the cold as much, but it's going to depend on the coat type and so on. So in your case, you may have to shorten your walks in the middle of winter or kind of limit them to just potty breaks outside and have lots of play and activity indoors.
It's kind of fun. In our neighborhood, we have lots of people have dogs. And as the last several days now, just watching dogs and their owners and the dogs some are having a great time outside, yeah. and others are just not want to be there.
And you know, and some you can, if they, you want to play dress up with them and get coats and booties and things, that may be helpful. One of my favorite types of booties to help protect dogs' feet, it's not going to prevent them from getting cold, but it will prevent the ice crystals and things from forming between the pads and prevent salt damage. They're called Paws, P-A-W-Z. They look like little balloons that go on. They stay on, they're waterproof, they're comfortable. Dogs can still feel the surface that they're walking on, and it kind of gives them a non-slip surface. So it might be something to consider to help your dog if they're uncomfortable with their feet, because I do see dogs like walking out there with their feet up, and that's time to say, all right, we're done, let's go home.
Gwen and Weyerhauser, thank you for calling.
Yes, I'm so delighted to talk to Sandy this morning. We just had an English Setter undergo a TPLO surgery about a month ago. Okay. And I guess my basic question is that we did not fully understand the tremendous commitment we needed, that we are making to help this dog rehab. And I wanted to know if you are familiar with any leashes or harnesses that keep highly prey-driven dogs from lunging and trying to run. He has not been leash-trained prior to this. He is a rescue dog, and I know now if we ever do that again, we're going to leash-train any dog we get. And then also I'm hearing of the high prevalence of the of tearing the other knee after a surgery like this. I just wanted to know what your comments might be.
Yeah,
it's, TPLO
is tibial plain something planing leveling osteotomy, I think. I don't know. It's a type of surgery where they go in, and I'm not a surgeon, obviously, but they reconfigure the end of the tibia that's coming in contact with the femur so that it puts less stress on the ligaments that are there, and to help stabilize the knee. And it works very well for dogs just because of the anatomically the way they are built. Doing any other types of surgery sometimes isn't as successful, and especially for large breeds like this one is a setter, it would probably be the preferred surgery. But you're right, this is a huge commitment for several weeks to months afterwards to be able to keep the dog quiet, because we worry about them either breaking the plate or developing new fractures or something. And because this tends to be an anatomical defect in the knee, it's very common to have, in a high percentage of dogs, the other one happen at the, you know, at some point, usually within the next year. So start saving your money for the second one.
Yeah.
If your dog is overweight, this is the good time to get the weight off of your dog. I've had some dogs that they just will not want to sit still, don't want to be cage rested. And we have to actually medically manage them with sedatives and things to be able to keep them calm and quiet, so that they're not going to be trying to overdo it. One of the harnesses that I really like that gives you good control over the dog's kind of front end and back end is called the Help 'Em Up harness, and you can order these online. They come in various sizes for male and female anatomical differences, so that they can wear this thing all the time. And then you've got like these suitcase handles that you can use to be able to control the dog. It's not a leash, but it does give you kind of your both arms being able to help the dog up and keep them from slipping and falling and being able to take off and run. Now, you are going to have some upper body strength to be able to manage some of that as well. But I think that might be something that you would find very helpful during this rehab program.
Well, we were very lucky. My husband just retired, and we were wondering how we would have done this if he were not, you know, available 24/7.
Yeah, it is a very, very difficult, and it is something to be thinking about. And we've had some dogs where they have to go to, you know, come into the hospital and just day board for, you know, during the day, so that they're in a kennel if they can't be left alone at home. Sometimes we have to use pet sitters. We're really lucky in the Madison areas that we have a number of veterinary technicians that do pet sitting and are able to come in and actually do some of the therapy that is needed. Obviously, it's going to be adding another expense to having this done, and it is an expensive surgery. But it sounds like you're handling this really well. But you know, my good luck, and I know, you know, just plan on maybe within the next year you're going to have to do it again.
Yeah, I guess my closing comment would be that I've had temptation to use some of the dog's trazodone recently.
Yeah, and that is one of the drugs that we use as kind of a calming drug that's not going to have a whole lot of side effects. And it is a drug that is used by humans, but I don't recommend you take it without checking with your physician.
What is a surgery like that? Run.
You're looking at probably $3,000 to $4,000.
Wow.
Per knee.
We're already over $4,000 with the investment of equipment.
Right.
So, yeah. Sandy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Graham. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Robin in Milwaukee up next. Robin, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Nice to talk to you.
Appreciate your call. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a 14-and-a-half-year-old dog, and he was diagnosed with cancer, melanoma.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, you know, I did consult with an oncologist, and I was given a couple different options to treat. One was Palladia, which would be full-dose chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
One was low-dose chemotherapy, the chlorambucil.
Chlorambucil?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
And a third option was going to be steroids.
Yeah, and there's also a melanoma vaccine, so that might be something else that they, I don't know if they discussed that with you as
no,
well. Okay,
not at all.
There is a melanoma vaccine, and I really don't know that much about it. It's a transdermal vaccination, and so it has to be done with this special injector, but that might be something to discuss with the oncologist if you get an opportunity.
Okay.
I think those are all very logical things to be thinking about, and it really is going to depend on, you know, you have to weigh out the expense, the side effects, and things like that. Typically, chlorambucil is fairly well tolerated, at least the patients that I've had on it. I, again, not being an oncologist and working in a veterinary school with state-of-the-art oncology, I refer all my patients there. And so they sit down and talk to everybody, and I sometimes act as a little fly in the wall and try to listen and learn from them.
Sure.
But it's you're always going to be probably second-guessing yourself. Well, if I did this, would they live longer? If I did that, would they? You know,
right.
And it's all based on odds. And
right.
I wish I could help you one way or the other. But I think if you were given the option of using chlorambucil, it may be something that your dog would tolerate well, and
right.
and it have some good quality of life. And remember, anytime we're using it, putting animals through chemotherapy, our goal is not to cure them from cancer, but to improve their quality of life,
right.
and help give you more time with them. And so we don't use drugs in combinations or dosages that are going to cause significant side effects, because we don't want that. We want them to be happy while they're on their chemo.
Right. That's good to hear that. That's what I was told, and I just like the second opinion, and I thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Thanks a
good
lot,
luck.
Robin. Yes, good luck. Appreciate your call very much. We have Juanita emails that her puppy got a dewormer and they saw yarn-like worms in the dog's feces. Family has another dog and cat. Should she be concerned? The older animals don't like the puppy and don't share sleeping spaces.
Yeah, it sounds like this puppy probably had roundworms. About 97% of puppies are actually born with this type of parasite. They are transmitted in larval stage across the placenta from the mom while the puppies are in utero, and they're also transmitted through the milk. And so for the next month after the puppy's born, they may be getting these larvae actually going in through the milk and right into the dog's intestinal tract. And so that's one of the reasons why we always recommend to breeders to start deworming these puppies at about 2 weeks of age and do it every 2 weeks until they get to be 10 to 12 weeks of age. So your dog had a good belly load of these things. The big risk is if you were to leave fecal material out in the environment, it takes about 2 weeks for those eggs to become infective, and that would mean that it would be a problem for your other pets. Now, dog roundworms are not going to be typically transmitted to cats, but your other adult dog could potentially get them. And that's one of the reasons why we recommend year-round heartworm control, not so much for the heartworm disease end of things living here in Wisconsin where mosquitoes disappear during our cold winter months, but because it also all of the heartworm preventatives provide intestinal parasite control. So if your adult dog is on one of the monthly heartworm preventatives, your dog should be safe, because if they do get exposed, you're going to be treating them right away. But do a good job of picking up that stool. I'm actually more concerned about your health, because people, we don't get roundworms, but those larvae that if we were to ingest some infected eggs, they can migrate around our body, and it is responsible for causing, I believe, about 700 cases of blindness in human beings, primarily in children throughout the United States
every year.
So they're in the soil, so do a good job of picking them up and maybe talk to that breeder and say, hey, you better, you know, start getting on a good deworming program to not only protect the puppy, but to protect the environment and protect people and other pets.
Dennis in Wautoma has a question. Hi, Dennis.
Hi there. How are you folks today?
Great. Appreciate your call. What can we do for you?
Well, I've got about a 10-year-old Doberman who we've had since we rescued him at about 18 months old, he was in a puppy mill that failed, and he was a sire, and he nearly starved to death, and he bonded to me especially closely, and now for the past 8 years has had separation anxiety whenever, not only, it used to be even worse, if I just left to go to work, he would literally whine for 8 to 10 hours while I was gone, sometimes howling, but he still does this, even though the veterinarian we deal with has put him on Prozac, or the generic Prozac, for the past 7 years. He gets 2 to 3 pills twice a day, but he still, because my sister passed away a year ago next month, and we adopted her 3 pugs, and we also have 3 men pins, and he's somewhat jealous, so whenever there's whenever we're giving some of the other dogs, or I'm giving some of the other dogs attention, he will sit and whine, and it drives my partner insane. I mean, the whining, sometimes it's, if I'm out working in the yard, I almost have to have him with me, because he will sit in the house and howl so loud that I can hear him outside.
Oh my goodness.
Or if he's on the patio, or the great big huge, we have an enormous outdoor patio. We here, we're 3 miles outside of town on a 7-acre estate. And, we can put him out there, but if I'm in the house and he's out there, he will raise such holy hell that I have to bring him in the house. Fortunately, I don't have neighbors he can annoy, but
it's bad.
And you got to think about, you know, just the happiness of the dog as well if they get that distressed. And this is a really serious behavior problem, and it's probably one of the reasons, you know, we see a lot of dogs end up going to shelters and then get readopted out, and then they, you know, bond with the new family, and they start showing signs that, hey, you're walking out of the door, I'm being abandoned again. And so it's quite common in rescue dogs to have this type of problem, not to the extent that your dog has. So some of the things that we recommend, you've got your dog on a good anti-anxiety medication. You may want to try some of the, you know, ancillary things like the anxiety wrap, using a dog appeasement pheromone collar. There's some other like nutritional supplements that have anti-anxiety effects. There's one that's called Anxietane that you can get over the counter. It's made by a company called Veerback. And so that might be something, other things that you can try, but it comes down to behavior modification and training this dog that you can step away and the world isn't going to come to an end. And that's where working with an applied animal behaviorist that can show you some exercises, relaxation exercises, teaching the dog to sit or lay down and wait while you take a step away, 2 steps away, eventually touch the doorknob, go through the door, you know, and be on the outside for a couple of seconds and coming back in again. And it's a very gradual, slow process. I wish that you had got started with some of this behavior modification very early on. The longer this problem persists, the harder it is to get under control. So, you know, I think that besides working with your veterinarian, see if they can refer you to somebody that can come to your house and actually help you with, you know, dealing with this situation. You've got a really full house. You now have a pack of dogs. And some of that dog-dog interaction, too, could be addressed if you have someone at the house helping you.
So a certified applied animal behavior as
yes,
the way to go. And Dennis, good luck. Appreciate your call very much. Well, that is a full house.
It is. 6 little dogs and, what do you say, 3 pugs, 3 min pins, and now this Doberman mix. Wow. Yeah.
Wow. Feeding time must be quite...
I imagine.
Quite the deal. Diana in Chippewa Falls, your term. Hi, Diana.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, thanks for taking it. I have a 12, well, she's almost a 12-year-old, Brittany, and she was diagnosed with severe pancreatitis in the end of November of 2015, and she also had, I think, the, which goes along with it, three high liver readings, ALT, ALP, and GGT.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then over time, I've had two more blood tests, and they came down within normal range, except this last time, the ALKP jumped up a bit again,
mm-hmm.
and the ALT was still out of range as well. So my question, and what I've been treating her with is just Denimarin.
Yeah. That's a
pancreatitis.
That's...
She was also on an antibiotic, but then she's just been on Denimarin since then.
Yeah.
So I haven't had a blood test since the end of November. I'm going to have one at the end of January. She's been on the Denimarin. Is it okay to keep her on it that long?
Many dogs can stay on it for the rest of their life. You may want to consider looking into having an abdominal ultrasound done just to make sure that there isn't something else going on with the liver since the values dropped and then it sounds like they came back up again. Usually if we've got secondary liver involvement after a dog has had pancreatitis, because those two organs sit so close together that often the liver will become inflamed as well because of the inflammation that's going on in the pancreas. And typically they'll get back to being normal again after the pancreatitis is under control. So I'd be looking to see, is there something else going on with that liver that needs to be addressed? And that's where an ultrasound and potentially, if they see something, a needle aspirate of the liver would be helpful as well. But Denimarin is a proprietary form of a liver support agent. It's primarily milk thistle, but it's in a form that's quite readily available for absorption by the dog. Some of the over-the-counter forms that they make for people, we just don't get good levels in the dog. So that's why we like to go with that particular brand, because it's been proven to be helpful. It can be quite expensive to be using on a daily basis, but it is safe to be used daily for the rest of the dog's life if you needed to.
Okay. So, I'll get another test at the end of January. Because of her age, I do not want to go into any extreme measures for her.
And that's understandable, and that would be something to talk about with your veterinarian. It may be that, you know, it's if everything's kind of staying stable but elevated on the Denimarin, and your dog's happy and healthy and no outward signs of liver disease, it may be one of those things that, you know, are we treating the patient or are we treating the lab test? And in this case, it may be that we're treating a lab test and that the patient's actually doing fine. And sometimes, you know, that's okay to just say, you know, I'm going to draw the line of where I'm going to go with my dog.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And we will take more calls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. I'm Larry Mueller. We have callers online with some great questions, I'll bet. And the number to call is 1-800-642-1234. I have a great photo on our Facebook page from Sarah. Sent a photo of her latest addition to the family, a mutt, she says.
Look at that little puppy with a spotted belly and, just sound asleep,
cutie.
But I bet he's trouble when he's awake.
What about Carrie? She said, any puppy tips?
Puppy tips. Wow. You know, I think that, the big things that we want to do with puppies is as soon as they've had their first vaccination and a good health check, get them enrolled in puppy training classes, because that's going to help with socialization, not only to other dogs, but to people as well, because there's going to be all different types of people there. So don't be afraid to get your dog out and about. I would be avoiding places like dog parks, pet stores, and so on, where nobody is controlling the temperament of the dogs that are going in there or the health status of the dogs going in there. But all puppies going to training classes need to be healthy and happy. And so the risk of picking up a disease in that kind of situation is very minimal compared to the problems that would occur if you do not get your dog out and about and socialized.
Sandy on Facebook wonders if a dog can get worms or anything else from eating rabbit poop.
Thank goodness, no. Probably the worst thing is that you've packed rabbit fecal material on the dog's teeth. So I hope you are brushing your dog's teeth and your dog is not kissing you. But we will sometimes see a rabbit parasite that it's called Imeria. It's a type of coccidia. And sometimes a yeast that's called Cyniclomyces in a stool check on a dog, and all that tells us is that they had rabbit poop for dinner. It's gone in one end and out the other. Nothing that needs to be treated.
Beverly in Ironwood, Michigan has a question. Hi, Beverly.
Hi. This is great.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a male cat. He's like a year and a half old, and he was a feral cat, and he's just the most adorable cat I've ever had almost. And one day, well, I noticed that he had some blood on his tummy, and then we investigated, and we took him to the vet. But anyway, he would lick himself, and there's two places on his tummy, and he would just lick and lick and just lick it raw, and it would just bleed all the time. And then he had one on his tail, and he just lick and lick and just bleed. Mm-hmm. And so the vet put him on 2 weeks of antibiotics for twice a day, but nothing would happen. I mean, and he had whatever. But anyway, we got him a hood to quit him from licking, because mm-hmm. they had to quit licking it.
Yeah.
And that works because it's healed. And I even had to put some kind of insulation around his hood because, see, he would try to lick, and then the hood kind of would irritate one of them on the tummy.
Goodness. Oh, poor baby.
I know.
Yeah.
But I adore that cat. And how can we make him, and I don't want to put him on any drugs.
Yeah.
But how do you make him stop? I mean, he's been on this for going on 2 months now on his hood, so his fur gets real long like the rest of it, and he doesn't even notice that it's there. But, you know, I will kind of scratch on those places, and he will start with a little lick.
Yeah. The majority of cats that do this type of barbering where they're pulling the hair out and actually causing enough damage that they're breaking the skin will have secondary bacterial infections, and I'm glad that your veterinarian put your cat on an antibiotic, although 2 weeks is usually not enough for a skin infection. We're usually looking at 3 to 4 weeks to be able to get it under control. The great majority of these cats, the bacteria is not what's causing it. That's kind of going along for the ride now that the skin is broken. It's usually that these cats have either allergic skin disease, such as environmental allergies, flea allergy dermatitis, meaning that they're allergic to flea saliva. So having them on year-round flea control is really important as well. But allergies are right up there with causing this. And it can be food allergies. And it's not the food itself. It's ingredients in the food, usually the protein that cats are allergic to. And so typically, if I get one of these cats in, things that I would do is get them on a good antibiotic for the skin. I would also probably be treating them for fleas, and I may consider looking for a parasite. There's another one. In fact, that he was an outdoor cat, a stray cat. There's a parasite that is contagious between cats called Demodex. I may consider treating for that. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of great treatments for that. We're usually looking at using something called lime sulfur dips to be able to get it under control. But that, you know, that would be something that your veterinarian would probably do some skin scrapings to look for these mites, run a fecal examination because cats groom them off and you'll actually see them in the stool. And then I would put the cat on a hypoallergenic diet that is actually an elimination diet. So it's hydrolyzed protein. It's going to be a diet that you'll only be able to get through your veterinarian. It's not available over the counter. None of the over-the-counter diets can be used for an elimination diet trial, even if they say limited ingredient diets. they're usually still contaminated with some of the other things that, that we want to get out of that cat's diet. Then, you know, following that, be looking at skin testing for or blood testing for allergies and seeing if we can come up with something that would make your cat, we could use to be able to desensitize your cat to whatever they're allergic to. So it's a long, drawn-out process, and it's not something that we solve overnight. So I think it's time to go back to the drawing board with your veterinarian and you don't be afraid of using drugs. You're probably going to need to be using something to make your cat comfortable.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give John and Houstonsford a chance to join in. John, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got an odd situation for yourself and the veterinarian.
Okay.
My dogs are blue healers. One's a red healer, one's a blue healer. One is approximately 8, the other one's about 10. I have probably the best broke work dogs for cattle or whatever you want to use them for in Dodge County. Unfortunately, my dogs have never been on a leash. My dogs are pretty much free to roam. They never, ever leave the property, ever. And they watch the fences and they watch the cattle. And they are really important tools to me and my small farmette as far as cattle and things like that. The difficulty comes in not being on a leash is the male. It's almost impossible to groom him. Although he's not violent, he rolls on his side, he rolls over, but he fights like hell to get away from you, to brush him properly and forget about trying to clip his toes or look at his ears. His ears have some sort of swelling on them. It's caused both ears to droop over, and forget it. You can't get him to stand still because they were never, ever intended for being house dogs. They've never been in the house. If they come in the house, they freak out and they wreck things. They would much rather be on the porch or outside.
But even working dogs need to be, when they're puppies, trained to be handled because, you know, if they had burdocks stuck in their hair coat or something stuck in their mouth, are you able to get their mouth opened and get things out? So that's it's too bad that you didn't go through that early training. I think you're at a point right now where if there's something that needs to be done, you may be looking at needing to medicate them with some type of sedatives. Usually we're using injectables in these dogs so that we can get something done for them. And we see dogs like this come in frequently that just don't like having their feet touched. I had one in yesterday that I could not do an exam on. Even with being muzzled, there was no way I would be able to trim his toenails, do a rectal exam, do anything. And yet this is a family pet that sleeps with the owner and is quite a nice dog until he realizes that he's at the veterinary clinic and is going to have something done. So if you are working with a veterinarian, talk to them about potentially, you know, giving your dog some type of medication so that you can get all those procedures done that, that really need to be done periodically.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And Billy in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call, guys. I have a 7.5-year-old American Staffordshire Terrier, and she started developing small skin tags. My vet really didn't think much of them, but they're starting to develop all over her body, and we're starting to see them get to the size of a BB or a small P. And I just wanted to call and see if I should be worried if there was some other sort of more serious condition that she might have that these might be a sign of.
Yeah, typically it's kind of genetic. Some dogs just are more prone to getting little benign skin tags and little skin masses. We'd always want to find out what they are. And so if they're big enough to be able to put a little needle in to be able to confirm what they are, and some of them have an appearance of they're very classic appearance for things like sebaceous adenomas, which are little benign growths of the skin glands. These can potentially be either surgically removed or with cryosurgery. They can be taken care of. It may take more than one treatment. But if they're in an area where, boy, it's going to cause the dog trouble, like they're underneath the collar or the harness or between the toes or something where it's going to bother the dog, those would be the ones I'd be addressing. thing. For the majority of dogs that have this type of problem, it's more cosmetic. Fortunately, your dog has short hair. I mean, if Cocker Spaniels get these all the time, poodles get lots of them, and you know, they, those dogs have hair coats that are going to hide them, but that's going to be quite a, you know, cosmetically unappealing for you. And really, the only thing you can do is have them removed as they pop up. And we now do cryosurgery on these at the hospital. And like I said, it may take more than one treatment, but it is something that can be done awake and isn't really very, it's not painful. And dogs tend to tolerate it really well.
There we go.
Well, great. Thank you so much for the info.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. We have Frank in Wautoma. Hi, Frank.
Good morning. My daughter has a standard poodle, a large male. He's about 7 years old. He is gradually losing control of his back legs, and it's gotten very bad. She takes him to the vet, but the vets see no hope. She's thinking about acupuncture. Can you comment on that?
Well, acupuncture may help for pain control, and I don't know why the dog is losing its ability to move its back legs. It sounds like it's a neurologic problem. I would definitely look at getting a second opinion, and if they feel that it would be something that acupuncture may help with, you know, pain relief, it would be worth trying. If we have an acupuncturist at the vet school, and there are several others in the state, and a number of veterinarians that are getting certified as we speak. Because it is becoming a more popular therapeutic modality that we're using in the veterinary world. So it might be worth a try.
Yeah, why not? Give it a shot. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. If you have a question for her, call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org. Or post a question and photo on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And we'll be back right after this look at the news. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along. Thank you so much for listening in today. You know, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, we rarely directly talk about the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I wanted to bring that up because we've got a wonderful school here with great treatments.
I am so proud to be one of the faculty members at the veterinary school, and I think for me, it's just that even though I'm getting to work with students, which is wonderful, it's just the quality of care and the number of things that we can do all under one roof for our patients. And it is a place that is open to the public. We have not only our primary care service, but, you know, all the specialty services. You don't have to be referred by your veterinarian, although we do like to, you know, keep in touch with your veterinarian, and we do a good job of kind of daily reports and things like that as well. But it's, you know, I think, you know, give us a try and check out our website because we've got lots of cool information on there. UW Veterinary Care.
And have you put anything up yet, or I'm sure you've talked about xylitol now and peanut butter.
Oh, yeah. This is kind of a thing that I bring up, and it's amazing how many people don't realize how toxic xylitol, which is a sugar alcohol that's being found in a whole lot of different products that people consume. It's in gums and candy and mints and things like that because it's very helpful for reducing plaque and it helps stimulate saliva. But because it's got a low glycemic index, it's in a lot of foods that are designed for diabetics, and it's about 2/3 the calories of sugar. And so it's showing up in a lot of different things that we consume on a daily basis. And one of the newer products that it's in is peanut butter. And I know my dogs love peanut butter, and that's a great way to get the dog to take a pill is to put it in peanut butter. But now we have to start looking at the labels of peanut butter to make sure that it doesn't contain xylitol. What xylitol does, I said it was about 100 times as toxic as chocolate. And
that's
we
amazing.
All know about chocolate toxicity, yeah. But you know, this whole xylitol thing, all it takes is 1 to 9 pieces of gum for a 45-pound dog to develop a toxicity. It causes rapid secretion of insulin by the pancreas, and so the dog's blood sugar sugar drops. They become weak, depressed, and, you know, they start tremoring. They go into seizures and a coma and die. And these are dogs that they need to be into the hospital immediately if your dog has ingested anything like this. So keep your sugar-free gum away from them. Watch your peanut butter. Keep those chewable vitamins that have got this in it away from your dogs. And if your dog does ingest any of this, seek medical attention right away.
Cats?
Not a problem for cats.
Okay.
So,
That's good. Daniel in Mount Carroll, Illinois has a question for you, Sandy. Let's go there. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Larry and Dr. Sawchuk. I have a 12-year-old Labrador Retriever, and just after Christmas, who had a decreased appetite and panting. And I visited with my veterinarian on about the 27th, and he passed the physical exam. His x-rays didn't show anything. The blood work was relatively normal for his history of lab work. And we left with treating antibiotics, but he hasn't been able to get over it. His temperature on that visit was 104.9.
Ooh, okay.
And the next visit, it was about a week later, it was 103.5. And I guess what I'm struggling with is that, you know, if there was a diagnosis and it was either cancer or pneumonia or something wrong with his heart, I guess I could, you know, wrap my brain around it. But it just seems to be mysterious. Normally, you know, the dog would jump for his food and be willing to eat. And so we're at this point now where, you know, we have to kind of, we want to know what happened or, you know, and I guess my question is, you know, with these temperatures, I mean, what is it? And, you know, when we think of human temperatures, we come up with our own kind of, you know, answer on
right.
our own.
Yeah. Yeah. And we actually have a term for this where you don't have an open wound, you can't find anything wrong with the dog, and yet they have this kind of persistent, sometimes fluctuating fever. And anytime we get a temperature like over 102.8, I kind of look at that as the dog is having a problem with running a fever. And we call it fever of unknown origin, an FUO. And this is where we start looking at, do we have something like a fungal disease, like blastomycosis? Do we have cancer? Do we have a blood infection where we've actually, you know, got bacteria in the bloodstream, so we'll often have to do blood cultures? You know, do we have something like a infected disc, discospondylitis? Do we have prostate disease? You know, and so it's starting a search, and it's just systematically going through everything to try to find out what's going on with the dog. And for some of these dogs, it is a real mystery. But we have a, you know, great internal medicine group, and we get these cases referred frequently, and they are head scratchers in a lot of cases until we find out what's actually going on. And but it's, you know, it does take a lot of time and effort to try to get to the bottom of this. And so don't give up, but I'm sure there's a reason why your dog has a fever, and hopefully if you jump through the hoops, you can find out the reason so that a treatment can be done so your dog can have some good quality of life.
Absolutely. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Ellie in Bailey's Harbor has a question as well. Hi, Ellie. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Sandy. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. What can we do for you?
So my husband and I, we adopted a pit bull rescue this last spring. He's originally from Alabama, so this was his first winter with us in northern Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing is that he absolutely loves snow. He's just completely blissed out playing with snowballs and playing in snowbanks. He's not really set up as a breed for the cold weather. So we got him a coat, and we've been trying on different like little boots for his paws. But as much as he seems pretty happy outside, just as like general temperatures drop, his feet do seem to be bothering him if he's out in the snow for more than like 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if it's worth spending time outside with him, you know, not where there would be like ice melt chemicals or anything, just to kind of build up tolerance for his paws, or if we should just be completely protective at this point.
and yeah. just go for booties all the time.
Yeah, and yeah, you're not going to develop tolerance to cold. I mean, this is a dog that, even though they originated down south, even if this was a pit bull that was born, pit bull mix that was born up here, they have, very short hair coats, and they tend to be a breed that is less cold tolerant. And even the dogs that are designed for being in the cold, like the northern breeds, the Malamutes and the Huskies, they can't even stay outside indefinitely. They, if they are outside, they need to have shelter and a raised area. And you see even dogs that are running the Iditarod with booties on, because it's still is going to be a problem for them the longer they stay outside. So this is where you have to know your pet's limits and adjust your playtime outside to either more when it's less cold out, in areas where there isn't going to be antifreeze and salt and things like that down that are going to irritate your pet's feet. Consider getting booties. My favorites, I mentioned them earlier in the show, are these little ones that kind of look like balloons. They're called Paws, P-A-W-Z. They come in a 12-pack, different sizes, and they tend to stay on and keep. They're not so much to, they're not insulated, but they will keep the feet from getting wet and getting any salt buildup, and it may improve your dog's ability to stay outside. Washing your dog off when they come in, I think it's really important to wipe them down to get any outdoor chemicals and things off their body so that they're not irritating. You may want to be, just checking the feet more frequently too, because it may be that it's not so much the cold, but if it's, winter is dry and we sometimes see cracked pads and things that can be uncomfortable for the dog. And there's a product on the market called Musher's Secret, or there's even some homemade recipes for paw wax that you can use that will help protect the paws and help keep them from cracking and drying up. And that may make a difference for your dog as well. But it's your dog just needs all the winter gear, I think, to be able to be comfortable.
All right.
That's wonderful. So we can baby him as much as we want, is what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah.
Good. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Christy in Escanaba, Michigan, wonders about vitamins and supplements should she be giving to her 4-month-old Australian Shepherd. What kind of diet should she use for this puppy?
Well, I like to see dogs on a complete and balanced diet and not have extra supplements being given to them, because that's going to throw the balance of the diet off. So using a food that would be appropriate for your puppy, being an Australian Shepherd, they tend to really, you see some on the smaller end, some on the bigger end. But if the parents were your, typical, 45, 50-pound dog, I would be staying with a large breed formula, puppy formula, and until they're at least a year age or so before we start thinking of switching over to an adult formula. And I'd like to see foods that have gone through AFCO feeding trials, meaning that they've actually been fed to dogs and they've been able to see how these dogs grow and develop on them so that mistakes can be fixed before it gets out into the public. And you want to see that actually on the bag.
There's some sort of metal or something?
It'll say, it has to say on the bag, has gone through AFCO feeding trials, or if they've just formulated it to meet AFCO standards, that's what it'll say, formulated to meet AFCO standards, which means they followed a recipe, they never fed it to a dog or a cat, and now they're feeding it to your dog. So that's why I like to see them actually go through AFCO feeding trials. And so obviously that's going to be the big companies, the big national companies, not the smaller companies, because they can't afford to do it.
Yeah, there we go. Barbara in West Bend, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hey, Larry. We talked before. Thank you so much for your show. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
Being new to Wisconsin, I really appreciate it. Anyways, what would you call it? Sandy.
Yes.
Sandy. She's your expert, right?
Yes, she is.
Sorry, I couldn't catch her last name. Anyways, I just lost one of my two dogs, which was a Newfie, and I think Sandy already answered some of my questions about why she died, but At this point, I'm curious if my remaining Australian Shepherd, again, is going through some sort of depression, because he was brought in when the Newfie was already there. So all of a sudden, he is without a companion. So I'm asking, what is the right thing to do at this point?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And, you know, some dogs are just, they become so bonded with their housemates. They just don't know, you know, what to do, because maybe the other dog was the one that barked when the doorbell rang. So then they learned, oh, I got to go to the door, or was the one that said, hey, it's dinner time, or let's go outside. And so you've got the dog that's the leader and the one that's the follower. And some dogs just have a tough time taking on that role of being independent. Things that you can do would be to try to stay with the same schedule that you've had. So the same feeding schedule, exercise schedule, even though you're grieving, trying not to, you know, let your other dog know just how upset and sad you are, and try to put on a happy face for your dog. And I think that that's really helpful. And you know, getting out and lots of exercise, you know, a tired dog is going to be a well-behaved dog, is going to sleep better, and be a little happier. You may find that, you know, getting your dog into doggy daycare or into other type of play groups, going to the dog park may be helpful, just so they can have some dog companionship. But remember that your Aussie at home doesn't just want any particular dog. He wants the dog that he grew up with. And so don't be surprised if he's not as eager to accept other dogs in his life. And remember, if you want to get another dog, you're getting another dog for yourself. You may not be getting another dog for your Aussie. He may, you know, not want to have anything to do with them. So really take your time before you start looking at introducing another dog, and try on other dogs in situations where you're not actually adopting them, like doggy daycare or dog parks.
Yeah. Barbara, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate your call. Always tough to lose your dog, for sure. Ann in Green Bay has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Ann.
Hello, I'm just worried about that lady that called about the feral cat that's having all the skin problems and everything. I mean, here's a cat that went from eating a raw diet to now eating either a canned or a bagged cat food. So I'm wondering if there isn't some kind of a raw diet she could put that cat on, and at least to put it on some kind of omega-3 oil, because I think that might help with its situation. But, you know, like I said, here it is, a diet that it's used to eating raw, and now it's eating processed food. So
Yeah. And, you know, when you start looking at the things that cats are allergic to, we actually see cats allergic to rabbit. And so, you know, here if they're out in the wild and they're eating it, it may still be one of those things that they can develop a food allergy to. So, you know, the big issue with raw diets is, one, are they balanced? It can be very difficult to get a complete and balanced raw diet that is going to have everything that the cat needs in it, especially if you're making a homemade diet. But even the commercially available ones, when you start looking at them, many of them are not balanced. They may not have the right levels of taurine and other things that the cat may need to be able to survive. The other risk we have is not so much to the cat, but to the humans, with having problems with salmonella, listeria, E. coli. And so if you are thinking of using a raw diet, you've got to be ultra careful with using, you know, different utensils, different dishes, you know, really, you know, good disinfection after handling this, and handling their fecal material like it's toxic waste, because, well, it is, but it can even be more toxic for people because of the risk of these bacterial infections. So there has been no proof that a raw diet is going to be better for an animal with food allergies. And it's the processing of the protein does not appear to increase risk for allergic problems. Your thoughts of putting the animal on an omega-3 fatty acid, yes, that does have some type of anti-inflammatory effect. And I still think you have to jump through the hoops appropriately for a cat that's doing this type of barbering. There's a really wonderful article by a group called Veterinary Partners. And if you just Google first proper mowing, like mowing your lawn, it goes through all of the steps that we as veterinarians have to do to be able to come up with a diagnosis for this. It can be a really tricky diagnosis. Sometimes we hit it right on, right away. Other times we're looking at, you know, just one thing after another, different trials to see what we can come up with. But as a veterinarian, raw diets, no, not going to make a difference when it comes to whether the cat has food allergies or not.
And thanks, Ann, for calling. Scott emailed us that one of his dogs has a small skin tag at the outside corner of his right eye. The vet seems very concerned, wants the animal to see an eye doctor as soon as possible, but is not worried about other skin tags. Is the location what makes this so special? What might be going on?
Yeah, anytime we've got skin involvement around the eye, if it's going to be something that needs to be removed, you are going to be worried about getting those eyelids to be able to close and have the normal conformation so that the eye can function normally. And so, you know, even though it may just be a benign mass, if it is interfering with the ability for the eye to close, or it's big enough that it's going to deform the eyelids once you get it taken off, then sooner rather than later is what we need to do with these eyelid masses. So, yeah, I think getting it looked at by somebody else wouldn't be a bad idea.
And Lisa has a question. Hi, Lisa. Thanks for calling.
Hi, does the UW have a blood bank for dogs? And also, do you still do clinical trials? And if so, what website?
If you go to UW Veterinary Care website, we have a lot of the clinical trials listed there for not only some of our medicine department has some going on, but oncology always has stuff going on regarding clinical trials. And yes, we do. We don't have necessarily a blood bank. We have a very cold refrigerator that we do store our blood products in. But we do have a whole fleet of blood donors, dogs and cats, that go through a special testing to make sure that they are universal donors. They're kept healthy with routine dentals and proper diet and so on. But these are all owner-owned pets that take part in this. And the benefit is that they, you know, they do get free food and veterinary care and vaccines and a dental every year for, you know, having their pet donate blood. And not every pet can be a blood donor. We want them to come in and enjoy coming into the clinic and it not be a stressful event for them. And, you know, so we're always in the market for, you know, new dogs and cats that want to volunteer their time to be able to have this done. And obviously owners that can make the time commitment as well. And I think there's even some stuff on our website regarding blood donors. So feel free to go there and have a look.
And we have a link on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show as well to your site. So that's really great. A great question. And just going back to our Facebook page, Karen sent a great photo of Zoe, her rescue beagle mix, is trying out the old comforter, which is in the laundry basket.
Oh, my goodness. You know, and that's one of the things that a lot of dogs like to do is get in and burrow underneath things. And I like to let dogs have kind of a choice between where they want to sleep. Sometimes they want to be warmer, sometimes a little cooler. And so, especially in the winter when you may have a drafty house, look at having multiple sleeping spots for the dog. And for this dog, it's lucky enough to be able to fit in the laundry basket.
And Zoe looks very content. There's no doubt about that. And a great shot of
guinea pigs.
Guinea pigs, Scott. And Jen.
Yeah, they make such wonderful pets for children and adults alike. And my daughter had one named Leroy for years and years and was really sad when he got to be an old man and we eventually had to end his life. He ended up going into kidney failure. But, just wonderful pets. Oh.
Sandy, we'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be back in a month. We'll do this all over again. Thank you so much for listening. Tomorrow we'll talk about bald eagle watching days, among other things. In the meantime, stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.